an everyday story of love, contained in the second chapter of the book of Genesis. A kind of an everyday story of love, but not really. This is the first story. And I don't know whether exactly you'd call it of love. It's certainly a story of something, and it's a story of a marriage. I suppose people either overemphasize one thing or another to do with marriage. Maybe they might overemphasize the romantic element of marriage. So everyone just ends up happily ever after. People get married and that's it. You know, it's all happy after that. No problems after that. Sometimes people might emphasize the functional purpose of marriage. We had a tea towel that's as true now as it was when we got given it, when we got married 25 years ago. And the tea towel said this: it starts when you sink in his arms and it ends with your arms in the sink. A very functional view about marriage, I suppose, particularly from the wife's point of view. Some people just joke about marriage as kind of a restriction, as kind of chains around you. People say things like marriage is an institution and who wants to be in an institution and those kind of jokes. The Bible doesn't overemphasize any of those things. It does talk about love and romance, and it does talk about function and purpose, and it does never joke about marriage. But here at the beginning, we have the beginning of marriage. We have something foundational about marriage as the highest, as the most beautiful relationship designed for us to be happy, designed for us to be ready to serve God together, both romantic and purposeful, both about friendship and about function. It's not the only way to live and to be happy, but it is the usual experience of most people. And here in Genesis, Moses, who most likely wrote these first five books of the Bible, describes kind of the first marriage. And more than that, the core reason why marriage is, why marriage works, why marriage helps. That's what we're going to look at this morning from Genesis 2, verse 18, through to the end of that chapter. Just remember from last week that Genesis 2 is a close-up view of some of the things that happened in Genesis 1. Genesis 1 was the panoramic view of creation. Genesis 2 is a focus on man and woman in a particular place and God's dealings in particular with them. So that's what we're looking at as we work through Genesis 2. Let's look, first of all, at Adam naming the animals, his animal parade, from verses 19 and 20. The context, of course, verse 18, is looking for a suitable helper for Adam. A suitable helper in the task. What's the task? Well, it's of working and taking care of the garden and extending out from the garden that's in Eden. It's the task of ruling and subduing. And in this task, Adam has no suitable helper. Verse 19 onwards talks about the moment of naming the animals. If you're a literal seven-day person for creation being in those 7 days, then this has to happen on the Friday, the day that man is created and the animals too. If you're not, then you've got a bit longer. But bear in mind, it's entirely possible that it all happened in a day. He doesn't name every single animal here. And also, it's God who brings the animals to him. It's not like Adam has to go on safari and discover an elephant and a tiger and all those things, if you discover tigers on safari. But God brings them to him, and he names them. Just a few things to notice just immediately from that. The very fact that Adam is naming the animals shows us a couple of things. For one thing, it shows us that he has authority over the animal kingdom. You know that the people who invent things almost invariably name them. You invent something, you give it its name. It's either named after you, it's given your name, or it's given some name that you first gave it. And that's the name that it has. It gets translated into all different languages slightly differently, but basically you kind of start off with the first name. Adam has rule over all the animals, so he names them. And God's showing that man's authority, or man has authority, delegated from God, but given by God truly, to have authority over the animal kingdom. It also shows, of course, that Adam is an intelligent being. You know, he's not like Fred Flintstone wearing a skirt and wielding a club and sort of grunting. He's a real man. He's a man that we would recognize as someone who can speak and as someone who can categorize, as someone who would understand words and ideas and categorizations and species and all those kind of things. He's an intelligent man. You know, it's okay to pen up cows and sheep and horses. We thought about that already last week and the week before, that we are in authority over creation. We are to rule and to subdue. So it's okay to rule. And it's also worth just noting that we are different from the animals. We thought about that in terms of creation, that we are made in God's image. We thought about that last week in terms of God breathing life into us and God speaking directly to us and God commanding us in a way that he doesn't with any of the other animals. So we are different, we are separate. And in all the animal kingdom, there is not an entirely suitable helper for us. We are different from the animals. Your pet dog or your spider are not in authority. They don't know best. They can do great things. If you saw Britain's Got Talent last night, you might have seen. I don't watch it, by the way. I just happened to wander in, you know, when it was on. It's what blokes always do, or parents always do, actually. You go and sit on the edge of the sofa, not actually wanting to say you want to watch it, but just seeing a bit. Anyway, there's that amazing dog. Did anyone see that dog last night that could do all this kind of dancing with its paws and stuff on its... Anyway, very entertaining dog, but it's only a dog. It's not a human being. It's not got the same intelligence, and more significantly, it's not got the same connection and relationship with God and the same responsibility in terms of ruling and subduing. And it won't be perfect company. Yes, they're intelligent. Yes, they can balance things and follow instructions. Yes, some animals are so intelligent they can interpret radar signals, but it doesn't satisfy the desire for human company, for a co-worker, for a friend, for somebody to love. It's not a substitute for human relationships. So Adam names the animals. Secondly, God makes woman. Verse 21 through to the first half of verse 22. It's not good for man to be alone, verse 18. The end of verse 20. But for Adam, no suitable helper was found. The animals are great, but the picture is incomplete. Adam needs someone alongside him. Adam needs someone who's the same as him. Adam needs someone who's a complement to him. Adam needs a helper who's suitable. A helper means someone who helps. But don't think about the word helper as meaning someone who's inferior. Don't think of it as being kind of synonymous with the word for slave or skivvy or servant, something like that. It's not talking about inferiority. If you look through the rest of the Bible, quite often God himself is described as our helper. God is our help or our helper. So it's not a word about inferiority, but it is a word about action. It is a word to some degree about function. So man needs a helper, and he needs a helper who's suitable. And that's a very rich word, meaning someone who's adapted, someone who's complementary. And together, suitable helper... All the different translations have kind of struggled to work out how to translate it, but together it means something like this. A counterpart, or a counterpartner. Well, that's not really a word, but a counterpartner, or a corresponding fit, or a suitable helper, or a suitable partner. That's what Adam needs. A counterpart. Someone who corresponds to him. There will be different functions. There is... Even here, a sense of order in creation. There is a hint of authority in the sense that the man names woman. But it's clear there's no sense of difference in dignity or relationship to God. There's no sense of being a servant or a slave. But what Adam needs is someone who will complement him, who will complete him, someone who will be his companion, someone who will be his business partner, someone who will be his co-worker. What Adam needs is woman. It's not simply that he's alone and needed company. Poor old Adam, he's a bit lonely. There is a sense of that, and we'll think about what that means in a moment. There is a sense of that, but it's not just that. It's not just that Adam is incomplete without woman. Although both those things are true, but more than that, he needs company for a particular purpose. He needs company in the task of ruling, of subduing, of working, of taking care of enjoying the world. Who is going to work with Adam? Who is going to stand on a mountaintop with Adam and say, wow, that looks amazing? Who is going to stand and watch the sunrise with Adam and say, that's beautiful? Who is going to help Adam when he needs help? Who is going to boost Adam and say, keep going? Who is going to understand Adam? That's what Adam needs, woman. Who's going to cultivate with him? Who's going to procreate with him? Who's going to relate to him? So God makes or God builds a woman. It's actually the word for build, like when you build a temple or when you build a massive house or other building. God builds around the rib from Adam, woman. It is the word for rib, but could be translated rib, but it also could be translated side. So it could be just that God takes a chunk out of Adam, as it were. Just in case you're privately wondering as a man how many ribs you actually have, and you're sort of secretly trying to count them. I found it impossible this week. I've been trying to count just to check whether it's true or not, but apparently we have 12 ribs. And whatever precisely happened with Adam, men and women have the same number of ribs. It's not as though God took something away from Adam and it's passed on. You know, if you break your leg, it's not as though you have children who have broken legs as they emerge from the womb, is it? So even if Adam's missing a rib for the rest of his life, then his children will have the right number of ribs. So there we are. We all have 12 ribs. We learned something this morning. But God builds woman around whatever he takes from Adam. It's to put right in front of us the fact that woman so directly corresponds to man. You could say, you know, why does this story kind of slow down here? Why does God spin it all out? Because for the creation of all the other species, it talks about male and female creating them. Why does it slow down for talking about man and woman? You know, when it comes to dogs and bitches, it doesn't sort of slow down and give us that same great description. There's something particularly being emphasized here. I've got no reason to doubt that God did it in the way that's described here, that made it in the way that's described here, but that's not the reason we're given this piece of the story. It's not just so we know how it happened, it's so we slow down and we stop and we look. It's so I can be here this morning actually preaching a sermon about this particular subject, because there's quite a bit on it. It's to see the differences and the similarities between men and women. It's been well said that woman comes from near the man's heart, to be near to the man's heart. Woman comes from alongside the man, from his side, to be by his side. Neither above him nor below him, made of the same stuff as him. And it's so we can see that man will take the initiative and join with woman to make a new family, as we'll see in a few moments. In the film As Good As It Gets, Jack Nicholson is asked, he's a writer in this particular film, he's a writer of, I think, romantic novels, and he's asked by a woman when he goes to his publishing company one day, a fan comes up to him and says, how do you write like a woman? How do you do it so well? How do you write like a woman? And he says this, I think of a man, and I take away reason and accountability. It's a great line, but it's not the biblical picture, is it? It's not what we're told in the book of Genesis. It's not the woman has something taken away from her. It's not the woman is inferior. It's the woman is built around man to complement man, to be a helper to man, as God is a helper to us, to complete man. That's the description of a woman. It's a great quote I saw from John Calvin. Some of you think of Calvin and Calvinists of being sort of dull, and you wouldn't think of John Calvin as being an author of romantic novels, would you really? I don't think so. But he says this in commenting on these particular verses, criticizing those who are, in his day, talking very functionally about women, you know, that they're just there for sort of producing children or something. And he says this: woman is not just a companion of the chamber, in other words, the bedroom, not just a companion of the chamber, but the inseparable associate for life. Inseparable associate for the whole of life. God makes woman because it's not good for man to be alone in the task of ruling and subduing. So, let's think about the wedding from second part of verse 22 through to verse 25. No invites, no fancy car, no photographers from Hello magazine showing up, just him and her. Plenty of flowers, great place for a reception, and just look, who's walking down the aisle with the woman? It's God. And Adam speaks, perhaps Adam sings. If you're into Shakespeare, you might say this is a soliloquy. That Adam utters here. Of course, he must have spoken before because he names the animals, unless he wrote it down or something, but we'll assume that he's already spoken. But these are the first recorded words of Adam. And he speaks in the style of a poem. That's why it's set out slightly differently in most of our Bibles. And he says, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, for she was taken out of man." Maybe it's a poem. Maybe it's a song he sings. I wonder if perhaps that's why our appetite for love songs is endless. Every generation is interested in love songs. You'd have thought we'd kind of got the idea. You know, why would we be interested to hear another sort of boy meets girl, I love you, it hurts kind of song? But they're endlessly produced, aren't they? Perhaps they're following the pattern of Adam here. When he says, "This is now," it sounds a bit kind of dull, doesn't it? This is now, okay, it's happened. But what he's actually expressing is this. Oh, at last. That's what it actually says. At last. Finally, finally, someone who understands me. You know, you can only go so far with aardvarks through to zebras, and actually, it just doesn't cut it. It's just not it for me. You see, they don't talk. They don't have the same feelings. They don't have opposing thumbs, so they can't help me in the task. Can't reproduce with them. There's actually great limits to the fun I can have with all these animals. At last, someone like me. Take them from my side to be by my side. Adam says, here's the perfect complement. Here's the counterpart. That picture that you saw for a few fleeting moments at the beginning was from the film Jerry Maguire. And you may remember in that film that sort of as the romance is developing, boy and girl, they meet in a lift, and there's a deaf person in that lift who signs something, which becomes significant later in the film. The deaf person is signing to their deaf girlfriend, a little sign. And then much later, when Tom Cruise has gone off and done lots of bad stuff and returns to his house, and he makes the sign language for this expression where he says, "You complete me." He says, "You complete me." That's a lot of old romantic nonsense, that particular film, but it expresses what's a good Bible truth, isn't it? Man, woman, man can say, "You complete me. You're the perfect complement. You're the perfect counterpart." And so he names her woman. In chapter 3, he's going to give her a slightly different name, the name Eve, the mother of the living, but here he names her woman. And in the Hebrew, even more so than in the English, the word for woman is very, very similar to the word for man. What he's trying to say is, you are so like me, you're almost me, but you're not quite me. You're so close to me, but you're not quite me. That's what he's trying to say. So Adam speaks, or sings, And then the author of the book then makes a comment from verse 24. He says, for this reason, because of what I've just described to you, then a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife. Even though here there's only Adam and Eve, and I suppose in that sense it's not a normal wedding that's going to be experienced through the rest of history. But what the Bible says is that here, this wedding sets a pattern. Because a woman perfectly complements a man will leave his family and join with a woman and make a new family. So it sets the pattern. And it's also described as being one flesh. They will become one flesh. That's talking about sexual union. It's talking about being one in purpose. It's talking about being one for life. Again, literally, it's to be stuck together, to be bonded together for life. And Jesus Christ describes this as it's meant to be an unbreakable bond. We know that we live after the fall. We know that we live in an imperfect world. We know that it doesn't always happen that man and wife do stick together. Some marriages don't go the distance. But we can't lose sight of the fact that in the beginning, in God's plan, before the fall, before sin enters the world, and even now, the plan is for one man and one woman bonded together for life, sharing in love, sharing in sex, sharing in bringing up children, sharing in working for the glory of God. One flesh, and then finally verse 25, the man and wife were naked, they felt no shame. Of course it means they weren't embarrassed. They weren't going to sort of come out the shower without their towel on and go, ooh, like that. Of course it means that sort of no shame. They're not embarrassed in that sense. But more than that, this expression about them being naked and feeling no shame is that they felt no vulnerability. They didn't feel that they were going to be exploited by the other. They didn't feel like the other was going to compete with them. They were naked and they felt no shame. They were completely open to one another. Of course, that expression sets up the shame that they will feel when we look at chapter 3 and when they disobey God. They suddenly feel vulnerable to God and to each other. But in the beginning, it wasn't so. They were naked. They felt no shame. And although there is a sense in which we always now, after the fall, feel the shame of nakedness, feel the vulnerability of nakedness, never quite feel completely invulnerable, there is a sense in which that can be recaptured in marriage. That sense of being open, of being naked, literally, mentally, physically, spiritually, with one another in marriage, and not feeling so vulnerable in that. I just want to close by drawing out one or two lessons from what we've been looking at. Try to work through those things at reasonable speed. And I just want us to think, okay, what does all that mean? We've talked about what it means in connection with animals, but what does it mean in connection with our relationships? Well, the first thing is this, that we are social beings. Might be a statement of the obvious, but we are social beings. Yes, fish will sometimes work together in schools, and wolves will hunt in packs, and termites will work together to build mounds. Animals can work together, but we're social in a different sense than that. We're not just social to get fed. We need each other to work together, but for more than food and for shelter, we need each other to work together for wholeness, for completeness, for living in God's world, for God's glory in the way that He designed. We need to talk. We need to tell our feelings, our ideas, our plans, our loves, our hates. We need to surround the purposes of God and follow after them. We need to find meaning in God and talk about that meaning that we find in God. We're social. Some of you may not be very social, but we're social. We're social beings. However unsociable we might think we are, we actually need and depend on connections with other human beings. And marriage is the normal, it's, you might say, the ultimate way to fulfill the social need for friendship and for a shared purpose. Marriage isn't what makes a person whole. What makes a person whole, what makes a person complete, is knowing Christ. But the way God has made us is that there is God to relate to, and there is us, but there are other people to relate to as well. And God always has saved people in community. He saves people individually, but he saves people in community. It's always been God's design for people to live in community, in connection with other people. Not idolizing other people and relationships with other people, always worshipping the Creator God, but worshipping together in connection with other people. And real purpose and dignity is found in knowing God through Christ and being able to serve together, whether you're married or whether you're single. And it's very important, if you are single, to make sure from your point of view that you get connected with families in the church. And it's very important for the church to be a place where everyone can belong and feel part of the family and feel in partnership together serving God. So we need to recognize that. We need to say that what's generally true is not necessarily true in your life. If you're single, that may be a temporary thing because you're young, or even if you're older. Or it might be a permanent thing, as far as you can see it, at least. Only God knows that. But unless it seems clear that God has different plans for you, it's perfectly reasonable to be looking for a life partner. It's a perfectly reasonable thing to do because it's generally how God works. And it's always worth considering whether the Lord has already brought someone in front of you. You could say Adam doesn't have a lot of choice, really. You know, do you want this one? The choice is this one or nothing. But it's not like that. There is a sense in which God sometimes puts people in our way. It could be a husband or a wife, and we're just looking the other way. You know, as a bloke, you want someone who looks like a supermodel, you know, who can cook like Nigella Lawson or Jamie Oliver or something, you know, who has the intelligence of a university professor, you know, who's athletic and all those other things. You've got a sort of long list. Come on, you guys, you have, haven't you? Of what you're looking for. I don't know what women look for in men. You have to tell me later. But sometimes, and if you're a Christian bloke, you can be even worse. You can have all those things on your list and you say, yeah, and I want it to be spiritual as well. And all the time, God's put someone in your way. Now, I understand the way of things in the world, I think. That you have to like someone, you have to be attracted to someone. That's the way God has made us. You know, so don't just marry someone who will be functionally very helpful. But beyond that, don't be too picky. Choose the people that God has put in your way. If you're a woman, look for someone that you can work with. Don't look for a bloke that you can fix. That's not what's being described here. Don't think, you know, this guy is such an absolute mess, I'm going to marry him and fix him up. That's not what's described here. Think of someone that you can help. Think of someone that you can work together with. Because believe me, there's all the things you can see you need to fix before you get married. There's a whole load more when you get married that you discover you have to fix. There's just too many things if you already start thinking, I'm going to fix him. But women, think of someone you can help and work with. Because men, we need help. And I don't mean help to make the dinner and to clean the clothes. I don't mean help to do the ironing. We need help to work together to glorify God in his world. We need help. We need advice. We need someone like us. We need someone who understands us. We need someone who compliments us. We need someone who can speak to us honestly and openly and tell us when we're being wise and tell us when we're being stupid. We need help. We need helpers. We need to be helped. We need to be helpers. And if you're married, make sure that your marriage has an outgoing purpose. Marriage is about fulfilling our own desire for social contact. It is about fulfilling our need for friendship and for comfort and for companionship. Marriage is about that, but make sure that your marriage has also outgoing purposes. Because you see, Adam and Eve, they were supposed to rule and subdue, to go out and to take care of the world. That was an outgoing purpose. It wasn't about, you know, Adam and Eve playing happy families kind of in an isolated way, just serving each other. It was about help in the task of being out in the world, subduing, ruling, taking care of the world. So make sure your marriage has that outgoing purpose to it. And it's also worth noting that intimacy, as described at the end of verse 25, the man and his wife naked and felt no shame. Intimacy is for the grown-up. It's for the committed. You see, it's a man, not a boy, who leaves his father and mother, who starts a new family. And it's a man and a woman who are united, who become one flesh, who are committed, who are stuck together for life. So intimacy is for the grown-up, and intimacy is for the committed. Don't go grabbing intimacy if you're not grown-up and you're not committed. To share a bed with someone is both a mature decision and a decision for life. Because in the Bible, and in God's plan, and he knows what he's talking about, in God's plan, sex is never separated from committed allegiance. That's what one flesh is talking about. So let's be thoughtful this morning, thinking about all we've learned. But let's also be thankful. This morning we're all shapes and sizes, but many of us are in very happy relationships between a man and a woman. And we can be so thankful for that, that we are both helpers and we are being helped. Let's be thankful for what we have. Let's think, although we live in a fallen world and although we do mess up and although we are failures, let's think, how can we try and serve this original purpose that man and woman, united, committed for life, glorify God in God's world? Let's pray for God's help to do that.